soundscape. They're touring on their latest release, Persona, opening the show are Full Catholic and Laura Hugo. More information about Pool Boy in the Pillar form is available at pillar.com.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them, and not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Hi, this is Al McFarlane, host of The Conversation with Al McFarlane. You're listening to 98.3 FM, KFAI, Minneapolis. I'm Al McFarlane. Welcome to The Conversation with Al McFarlane. I'm glad to be here and glad to have you along as well. I hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving and have sort of a fulfilling set of plans for the season that we're moving into, the holiday season, the Christmas season, and other ways people celebrate the end of the year, the new year. So I've had a great week. I had the good fortune yesterday of presenting, taping a future show for The Conversation with Al McFarlane. We'll announce when it's going to be aired, but we taped it at the Paradise Room at the Capri Theater in North Minneapolis. And it was a special edition of The Conversation with Al McFarlane because it had sponsorship support from First Bank. And this particular program was one where I interviewed one of the principals, one of the leaders, program managers at a project called the African American Leadership Council, AAAL Leadership Forum, African American Leadership Forum. And it was in particular about an initiative called Northside Forward. A number of community leaders, elders, program managers, and some young people from North Minneapolis were in attendance at the Capri taping of this special edition of The Conversation with Al McFarlane. And it was simply a good time to connect and to share and to respond to questions. The beauty of it was that, the heads of a number of the major legacy organizations in North Minneapolis were there to hear my guest, my interviewee, her name was Tyrese Cox, talk about the Northside Forward Initiative. And it's an exciting thing. The thing that attracted me to wanting to talk about it is that it's a declared intention to invest $1.5 billion over the next 10 years in specifically North Minneapolis. And this is kind of adjacent to, or maybe subsidiary to, another project we've covered. Groundbreak is a project that recently hired its new CEO and leader, Adair Mosley. And Adair Mosley was one of the people that shaped the Northside Forward Initiative. And what it was a convening of stakeholders, 200 or so people over a long period of time, analyzing six or seven areas of community activity with an eye, from a lens of what do we need to do together to move our community forward, to move towards health and healing, towards sustainability, towards livability, towards prosperity, and away from the narrative that has us describing ourselves and our lot in deficit terms. So it's a reorientation, a rethinking, analysis of where we are and ultimately who we are, and ultimately what we must do to both prosper and foster prosperity and engagement abroad in our community. Well, I'll tell you more about that, but I wanna say, first of all, I'm so always happy to be here on KFAI. This is a powerful resource in our community, and I'm happy that we are live streaming as well. We're streaming this show to Facebook, the Insight News Facebook, to the Insight News LinkedIn channel. We're also streaming it to two YouTube platforms, that of the Black Press of America, Black Press USA, and the Insight News YouTube channel as well. So if you're connecting on any of these platforms, we'd love to have you weigh in on the conversation, or you know, bring your thoughts, your concerns, your joys and sorrows to share with the community on this program today. And if you want to, we'll put on the screen here how you can get a link and join me in this conversation. We'd love to have you in the program. If you're listening on KFAI, we appreciate you. That's a big audience. It's our big audience. We really love being part of the KFAI family. And we want you to also be able to interact. And if you're on KFAI, if you want to just jump over to Facebook or LinkedIn or YouTube in particular, it's YouTube/InsightNewsMN. You'll show up in this program, the live streaming of the program, and you can leave a comment or chat. And if you like, I'd be glad to invite you on screen with me just to chop it up a little bit about things going on. What am I interested in? Well, outside of talking about the event that I did yesterday, I want to talk about an event I did a week or two ago that is a similar event, and that was hosting a summit. It's called the Black Men's Legacy Summit. It was held at the Thor Building in North Minneapolis. So the Black Men's Legacy Summit is about wealth building. It's organized by a group called Build Wealth Minnesota. A lot of great panels, a lot of great presentations. I'll talk about that. And that kind of segues into talking more about the event that I moderated yesterday, the taping of a future show for the conversation with Al McFarland. And that show focused on the work of Northside Forward. My guest yesterday was Tyrese Cox, who is a principal at the African American Leadership Forum. But I'm open for any conversation. If you want to talk about politics, about crime, about safety, about health, about national, international, we'd love to have you join the conversation and bring in your thoughts and your ideas. Well, one of the people that's regularly on board with me is my friend, Jonathan Palmer. Jonathan Palmer, Sir Jonathan, good to see you, my friend. How you doing?
I'm good. How about yourself, Al?
I am well. I'm inviting people to join the conversation. And anyone who'd like to can simply go to the either LinkedIn or Insight News channel and drop a note in the comment section, and we'll send you a link so you can join the conversation. Jonathan, I was talking about yesterday, I was doing a pre-taping of one of these shows, The Conversation with Al McFarland. I interviewed Tyrese Cox, who is a principal at the African American Leadership African American Leadership Forum, AALC. And that project called Northside Forward is an exciting opportunity for stakeholders in North Minneapolis to collaborate, to do something together to improve the quality of life and the sustainability of our community and, you know, the positive outcomes that we think we deserve. So I was talking about that, and I also mentioned that last month I also was part of the Build Wealth Minnesota Black Men's Legacy Summit. So those are the things that are top of mind with me. I'm also thinking about a couple of other things. The upcoming midterm elections. I stay glued to social media and television news, sort of watching and monitoring the latest antics coming out of the White House. I think this is just a laughable but dangerous situation that our country is in. I think that President Trump is a danger to this country and danger to humanity. And the danger may not be that he himself personally is dangerous, but the things he stands for and the things he is unleashing in depravity in a segment of our population spells danger. It spells danger in the sense that we may be at a place where if people want to go back to the good old days, to the Ozzie and Harriet, Leave It to Beaver days, or even back further to the turn of the previous century. I saw this documentary on PBS. It's still around. I can't think of the name of it, but it was about Wilmington as a city that was like a paradise for Black and poor people collaboration following the Civil War. And this it's called the Wilmington. I'll think of the name of it in a second, but and maybe Jared can look it up. Look up something about the Wilmington, Delaware massacre, it was called. But at the end of the day, when Black people and poor white people coming out of the South, the defeat of the South, and found ways to cooperate, and create economies that worked for ordinary people, allowed prosperity for Black people that they never seen before, but also invited white people who were sharecroppers and subsistence farmers and poor people, to enjoy opportunity for personal and family increase and development. And what it did was challenged the power and the hegemony of the aristocratic economic elite of the South and of North Carolina in particular. And that group met and willfully determined that it would not allow Blacks who were elected to the state legislature to take office and rode into the legislature. I can't remember the exact year, maybe we'll see it if we pull the story up, and told the Blacks who were seated and the whites who cooperated with them to become elected in North Carolina State House that if you don't leave, we will drag you out of here bloody, we'll kill you. And they proceeded to shut down the legislature and force people out, and then came up with trumped up charges, as always, about white women being attacked by Black men. And that led to armed militias camping around Black communities and opening fire and killing, murdering hundreds of people. In fact, here's a thumbnail of it. It's called the Wilmington Massacre of 1898. Jared, thanks for pulling it up. So if you're online, you can see this image here. And I'll just read the first couple of paragraphs. You can scroll down. It says, in the late 1890s, Wilmington, North Carolina, a port city between the Atlantic's barrier islands and the banks of Cape Fear River, became an island of hope for a new America. Residents of the city's thriving Black community made themselves a political force, exercising the rights of citizenship guaranteed to them after the Civil War by the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments across the South. Such activity had triggered deadly white violence against Black voters, organizers, and office holders in the decades since the war. But in Wilmington, a city of 20,000, the votes of 8,000 Black men helped a rare biracial fusion alliance between that could elect candidates of both races. In that city, three of the 10 aldermen were Black. The city had Black health inspectors, postmasters, magistrates, and policemen, even though the Black policemen couldn't arrest anyone white. But the county coroner, the jailer, treasurer were Black, register of deeds was Black, Black businesses pooled their money and created three Black-owned banks, and families only a generation removed from enslavement owned their own homes and read a local Black newspaper. Well, here we go. And it was a newspaper that promoted this idea of access, of equity, and of civic responsibility. And what the whites did was demanded of the Black community. They called a meeting, they sent a note out to all of the leaders of the Black community saying, your presence is demanded at 5 o'clock today at place so-and-so, and that's something of importance to your community, and do not fail to show up. So it was a note that they delivered to all the prominent Black leaders in the community, basically saying, you better show up or else, right? And when they showed up, they told them that You all have 24 hours to dismantle the black newspaper in that town and to shut it down and to ship out the printing presses. They didn't even want the presses to be around for anybody to use. And when that didn't happen, when they wanted it, they created situations that allowed them to, in effect, execute both a coup, which they had done, and massacre numbers of black people. Well, I think that we're kind of in that direction today. And maybe before we're over, we'll play just a little bit of the video from, oh, here's the meeting. So there'll be a meeting of white men in Wilmington this morning at 11 o'clock at the courthouse. Full attendance is desired as business in the furtherance of white supremacy will be subtracted. So that was one of the meetings. And out of that meeting came a meeting where they demanded that the blacks show up and get the orders to dismantle their press freedom. Jonathan, I am concerned that we're not far from that, but I also believe that even if that intention emerges, this is a different time. And I believe that our generation, our people, will not suffer that folly and that insidious lunacy and that bold effort to impose white supremacy again. It simply cannot happen and will not happen. What are your thoughts? Do you think about this like I do? I know you do.
Yes. And I appreciate that you're covering the Wilmington massacre. So every month during Black History Month, or every year during Black History Month, I post on my social media Black history that you didn't know. I try to find all those little nuggets and places, and then racism to be aware of. And so I've actually covered the Wilmington massacre before, and I pulled up one of my cards because there's a guy named Alfred Moore Waddell, who was one of the leaders of that. Mm-hmm. And when they did the White Declaration of Independence that asserted the supremacy, one of the things he said is that the U.S. Constitution did not anticipate the enfranchisement of an ignorant population of African origin, and that never again will white men of New Hanover County permit black political participation. Mm-hmm. And one of the fascinating facts about this is after they did this and the firebomb and everything, it wasn't until, I think, 1973 before there was any kind of change in things. It disenfranchised all blacks and many poor whites, making Russell the last Republican to serve as governor until 1973. And as we know, during the 20th century is when you had that shift over in power with the Democrats becoming more aligned with African-Americans and other people of color, and the Republicans going to the opposite side. You saw that shift in about the 20s when you had in the 30s when you had the New Deal come out, and so many of the things that were coming out of Roosevelt aligned more with poor people of all races. And so you had Democrats that were poor starting to say, hey, wait a minute, these are the things that are going to help us rebuild. Maybe we're not in the right space. And you had Republicans going, hey, we want to have more control. And so you see this shift that happens, and it cements itself in the Nixon administration. And that's how we get from racist Democrats and supportive Republicans of the party of Lincoln and everything back to the other side. And now we're seeing that shift that comes up. I think you're 100% right. The kinds of things that have been happening just in the last year, we're not even going back into the previous administration of the president, but the current one, it is so much unchecked power. Mm-hmm. It is so much that is happening that nobody is going ahead and taking a stand of. They're starting to realize, hey, maybe this is not the way that things are going to go. When you look at the fact that this person is having MRIs several a year for their explanation was it's normal for somebody of his age. That's not normal. MRIs and exams like that are used to further check on symptoms that were identified early. They're not used for diagnosis. They're used to go ahead and further understand what is happening once something has already been identified. So we have somebody who has not fulfilled the promise on bringing grocery prices down. has targeted poor people of all races, but especially focusing in on people of color with things like the SNAP reduction and going ahead and moving into things like 50-year mortgages, like that's really going to help somebody. And then this targeting right now that's going on with Venezuelans and the boats. There is a clear war on people of color, on brown people, of going ahead and casually murdering individuals. We haven't been identified that anybody in any boat is actually a drug runner or some sort of threat to the United States. And when you pardon the president of Honduras, previous president of Honduras, who brought in so much drugs to the United States, it kind of shows the inconsistency of the ethics and the principles that should be there are not being there and not being reflected. So there is a danger right now. I think today we're watching the election in Tennessee because that's going to go ahead and give an indication. It's a solidly red district, but it's in trouble right now. And so if the Republicans do win that district, but it's in single digits, that's a tremendous indicator for the midterms, that the midterms are going to shift the balance of power. And I think the president is scared of that right now. And so they are doing all sorts of actions, all sorts of things to distract from the Epstein files and that, the kind of destruction that will do to the administration and the power base and the different terms that are coming up in terms of how they're doing destruction at the White House, the, you know, tearing down the wing and everything. You're seeing things that if Barack Obama had done these, even if Joe Biden had done these, there would have been outrage throughout the House and the Senate. And yet, when people are clearly doing things like calling for the death of sitting U.S. senators, Republican Party is silent. It is an atrocity to our system of democracy. It is so much in keeping with where this, the Project 2025 and the president has been going. But you look back at what the community wants, what people want, what the balances of power are supposed to do when we have these checks and balances. It's all out of whack. And we need something to right size that and bring things back into balance.
What will it take? What do you think that is?
I think it's going to take a shift in the balance of power within the Senate and the House. I think it's going to take more progressive leaders. I am so happy Zoran Mondani being elected in New York. I think that is a brilliant opening. I think within Congress, it's really time to look at the young leadership. You know, all across the country, even on local levels, we need to be helping to raise up the young leadership. And I look at people like Jasmine Crockett and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Mondani and all of the younger leaders that are coming up. They should be being supported. They should be being thrust to the forefront. I think of people like Chuck Schumer, who's been there for ages. Mm-hmm. It's time to retire. It's time to go ahead and step to the side because the games where you used to be able to compromise. You know, you go back to a time when you could reach across the aisle in the Wellstone era. That was times where Republicans and Democrats just had different priorities. And you could go ahead, come to a compromise, reach across the aisle, and still collaborate. Now it is caustic on a level that is just unforeseen. And I listen to so many Republicans spin ways to support the things that the president is doing, and not even rational ways. It is supporting and saying, oh yeah, this is definitely the way we're gonna do. This is how we go ahead and improve the American public by going ahead and bombing boats and cutting SNAP benefits. This is the way that we get things to go. So I think it's gonna take a shift in the balance of power. I think it's gonna take activism at our local levels, people coming together and saying, this is not what the American people want. this is about America, this is about democracy, and we have to stand up for what is right for our country.
Thanks to our friend David Rabb, who wrote, "We're currently living in a ball of confusion." David, I'm going to send a link to you, and if you want to come on the program, we'd love to have you weigh in and join this conversation with me and Jonathan, and we'll send that link over to you, or Jared, maybe you can send it. He's in our previous guest file. And so as you were speaking, you know, you covered a lot of things, but they're all related. And that's why I think David is right in calling it a ball of confusion, mm-hmm. because you mentioned the Epstein. That's big, right? But then you also mentioned the bombing of ships, of boats, under the idea of a war on drugs off the coast of Venezuela and in the Pacific. And that also is a, you know, reflection of the massive military buildup in the Caribbean, threatening. What for? Why? You know, and then you have to weigh in that the question of rule of law, international law, and right now it's sounding like these actions make our country and certainly the ones who gave the orders war criminals, because there has been no due process allowed to those people that were killed under the aegis of our war on drugs. And I think, you know, the frightening thing was that in the most recent attack by our country, by our warplanes on boats off of Venezuela, a first attack crippled the boat but didn't sink it. And there were apparently survivors, right? And an order came to go and kill the survivors. That's against the rules of war. It's against human decency. And again, no due process. And apparently there were comments from Pete Hecht that, I'm not sure if it was about this particular incident or previous ones, where he said, we know who's on the boat. We know what they're doing. And because we know, we are comfortable with destroying the boat. So that's a judge and juror, right, over an alleged criminal activity based on your knowledge. I think that's really a dangerous place. And if they can do it there, they'll do it here as well. We know they have done it here. It's not like it's a new thing, because it goes back to the what happened with the public mindset following the Civil War, where white supremacy was exerting its ugliest self in ways that continue to devastate the idea of freedom and democracy for all Americans, but particularly to downpress Black Americans. So Venezuela's there, but then, you know, we're also looking at what's happening with Ukraine, and the war between Ukraine and Russia, and what the real truths are about why that war is being fought, and how, according to news reports, our policy is being spoon-fed to us, to spoon-fed to them, by Putin. And so is the U.S. an honest broker in this deal? That's something we have to discuss. Then we haven't heard as much lately about Gaza, because other events have taken the place, but they're still suffering in Gaza. And the question of what the status will be of the Palestinian people. Add to that, you mentioned, I guess in today's news, yesterday's news, President Trump has pardoned the president of Honduras, who was in jail in America, convicted by an American court, I believe, of allowing Honduras to support drug trafficking and drug sales in the U.S. And so if this is a person that the system has adjudicated for violating, you know, our laws, our president then turns around while on the one hand talking about stopping drugs and alleged drugs on boats in the Atlantic, but here releasing an adjudicated and convicted agent of drug trafficking. It doesn't add up, but it adds up because it's consistent with the malaise that is seated in the White House now. And that malaise is simply a reflection of this reemergence of what I think is a very mean and hateful spirit that really is characterized by what happened, again, after the Civil War. It's the reemergence of the sense of privilege and a sense of entitlement by white supremacists in our country. Let's listen to, there's a promo we pulled up of that PBS video on Wilmington. Let's check that out and come back. I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland. Check this out.
We have taken a city as thoroughly, as completely as it captured in battle.
It was the only armed overthrow of an elected government.
We really don't know how many people were murdered that day.
Whole families have broken up and scattered. The homes representing their savings are deserted.
I've always felt like this story was always meant to be told.
In North Carolina, the Negro holds the balance of power.
There was really no other major city in the South like Wilmington.
You have the black leadership with college degrees.
And there was a professional class there, doctors and teachers and lawyers.
White vendors are having to compete with black vendors for customers. And black men were able to hold public office at multiple levels of government. Wilmington is essentially a promised land for African Americans.
It was a different vision of what American democracy could be, that it could actually be multiracial and work.
Men, do your duty. This city, county, and state shall be rid of Negro domination once and forever.
The Confederacy was trying to take power back.
And white supremacy is going to be the rallying cry.
So leaders of the conspiracy turned to actually taking over the city government at gunpoint.
A definition of a coup d'etat is an armed overthrow of a legally elected government, which is what happened on this day in Wilmington.
This was a coup based on the devaluation of African-American citizenship. You think about the loss of wealth, the stealing of their generational legacies. What Wilmington tells us is how fragile American democracy is.
That's here we go. Yeah, that's a PBS, a trailer. It's called American Coup. And when I watched it, Jonathan, it was riveting and reminded me so much of where we could be here today, as you said, as a consequence of the Project 2025. What are your thoughts when you listen to that summary again? Unmute.
One, I'm going to go and check that out. I mean, that is fascinating. Like I said, I've covered it, but that's a lot more in depth than I've gone. And Wilmington is just one of those that is insane. I'm pretty sure, if I'm remembering correctly, that they forced the mayor to resign at gunpoint. Mm-hmm. I think it was. I mean, it is things that this is one of those pieces of history that.
Well, in this video, in this PBS documentary, one of the things that just blew me away is that, as I mentioned, there was black wealth, you know, mm-hmm. professional class. And so the leader of the white supremacist movement lived next door to the leader of the black community. Mm-hmm. Their houses were side by side. They were like families, one family and the next family next door, right? And while and the white guy apparently was saying, I can't have these people living the way I live, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the statements is that Negroes held, you know, black people held the balance of power because of their numbers, their voting power in that community. And so the one of the meetings they held where they brought all of the whites together to hatch the plan to destroy the black community was held next door to one of the prominent black citizens in that community. And that's just how ironic it is. So you're close, and even that close, you feel entitled and necessary to destroy another human being and to destroy a culture. It just blows mm-hmm. me away.
And this is part of the things that people don't realize. They think that Tulsa was the only center of Black wealth that got destroyed. But there are places all over the United States that this kind of thing happened, that cities were taken over. Central Park in New York used to be a Black community. Lake Lanier down in Georgia has a Black town underneath it. They literally flooded the town, and now it's a place where people go and they, you know, water ski and stuff like that over the top of the ruins of our communities. What has become this idea is that Black people, you know, were just poor and destitute and have never had wealth, never had anything. You know, it's like Black history began with slavery. Sometime later, Martin Luther King was born, and then Barack Obama became president, and that's all that happened. There was so much that came out of Reconstruction after the Civil War. And if that had been allowed to continue, you would have a much more balanced and equitable society right now. But we don't have that because there were mobs, literal mobs of white supremacists that went around that destroyed Black communities, Black towns. You can look at Rosewood, Florida. You can look at Tulsa, Oklahoma. There are cities all over this country that were destroyed through these efforts, and people don't know about them because we don't teach them in school. We don't talk about what happened to these different communities and what that means now, because the wealth was destroyed. The communities where there were homes were destroyed. So when you're talking about the position people have in society and being able to create networks, being able to create wealth within their community, being able to rise out of poverty and destitution, every time we've tried, we got knocked back and pushed out and run over. And so it's not as simple as our group doesn't try hard enough. African Americans or other groups of color don't try hard enough. It's that every time we get on to a ledge and start to move up, we are pushed over the side, and then that history is covered up and people don't know about it. So they think that, oh, that's just what that community is like. That's just what those people are. And these steps that have been taking right now are trying to dismantle the different communities. The things that ICE is doing in terms of attacking innocent Americans, claiming that they are they're here illegally and going ahead and profiling us. They're not going over after the worst of the worst. They're not going after the so-called, you know, gang members that have come in here in droves from the outside the borders. They're going after brown people. They're going after brown people who are Hispanic and Latino and Chicano, and they're trying to get them extricated out of the country to places they didn't even come from. And people are getting caught up in this. And then you have the profiling that's being done. This whole thing about Somali gangs roving through Minnesota. My daughter, my eldest daughter, stepdaughter, is Somali. And this is offensive to me on a level that is just far beyond what I can say. We have, Minnesota has been a haven for immigrant communities because it has been welcoming in many regards. There's a lot of pieces that needed to be fixed and still need to be fixed with how we treat immigrant communities here in Minnesota. But Minnesota still has been a better place for them to come. They have been integrated in our communities. They become brothers and sisters that we work side by side. I can rattle off a name, 10 immigrant communities and individuals who have worked to make Minnesota better, and yet they are being targeted because they are brown. And that's what this all comes back to. It comes back to white supremacy. It comes back to utilizing these methods and these seats of power to go ahead and create this narrative of fear, because that is at the that Black people and brown people are going to steal away your sanctity. They're going to take your home. They're going to take your women. They're going to take your land. They're going to do all these things. And yet, historically, it has been white people who are white supremacists who have done all of this. They have consistently destroyed Black communities, white communities, Asian communities, Native American communities especially. Don't even get me started on what has been done to our Indigenous brothers and sisters. And yet we are still being targeted as the boogeyman, as the one to be afraid of. But when you peel back the layer and see who is actually, it's like a Scooby-Doo villain. You pull off the mask and it's always the old white owner of the abandoned amusement park who is going ahead and trying to get these schemes and utilize that to go ahead and take away power and take away what has been built up and constructed for communities.
Let me bring another voice in, our friend Kenya McKnight Ahad. She's the co-founder founder and CEO of the Black Women's Wealth Alliance. And she also has an entrepreneurial venture called Zura on West Broadway, North Minneapolis. I was with Kenya yesterday with that presentation we had, the taping of a future show of the conversation. And that taping was interviewing Sister Tyrese Cox, who is one of the program directors for the Northside Forward Initiative. Kenya, thank you for being here. Good to see you. Good to see you yesterday. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm good. Good to see you as well. Hey, Jonathan.
Kenya.
So you hear us talking about just the state of affairs, and we started off, I don't know if you were listening in advance, just about what one of our listeners, David Rapp, Colonel David Rapp, said. We're living in a ball of confusion, and we're trying to thread the needle between all of these things like the Epstein, like Venezuela, like Ukraine, like Gaza, like the pardoning of the president of Honduras by President Trump, and like the White House positions on international law, et cetera. And so jump in wherever you want to, and maybe you want to bring a positive spin, because I think that even as we analyze all of the things that are challenging, we have to also be mindful of our resilience and our commitment and our ability to right the ship and to move community and humanity forward. Before you speak, let me remind people, this is The Conversation with Al McFarland here live on KFAI and across social media streams. And shout out to David Rabb and also to Darren Woods. And David and Darren, I put a link in the comment section. If you wanna join the program, we welcome you to just log on and we'll have you part of the conversation. Shout out to Michelle, also, who is a great supporter. Thank you for being here as always, Michelle. Kenya, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, we're definitely in a reconstruction era, right? Of, you know, and I think it's global and it's being, you know, driven, I think in this time by the United States and, you know, but certainly didn't start there, right? I think COVID sort of kicked off another deeper catalyst of this reconstruction that we're experiencing. I think that we do have a responsibility to respond. And that response is not always going to be favorable or what we like as the American pie. Like, we got to think about what's best for this country too, which ain't always accepting everybody. You know, from everywhere under all circumstances, that is not okay. Especially when we got our own issues too. And so in understanding what has happened to the globe under COVID, COVID has broken down a lot of systems in other countries. Like when I was visiting Egypt, I wasn't safe to just walk in, you know, in the mall and shop without, we had to have guards everywhere because the economy there was so collapsed in many ways that they were harassing us to buy, you know, and so I'm not, whatever it is, what it is, but I'm just saying that that's an impact that COVID has had on their economy, less visitors, et cetera, and it creates conditions in people, right? And we're experiencing that. Like when we go and travel, and then some of that is transferred here when folks are coming, you know? And so I know it's not popular, but it's a real thing, you know, that we are experiencing in our nation that has to be grappled in. And we just want to be this pie in the sky, everybody. But the reality is that the impact is real, right? We got folks in Chicago, African-Americans, right? Who are sitting there talking about, hey, you know what I mean? Listen, that's all good and great for humanity, but that ain't extended to me, right? You know, how do we think about, you know, prioritizing local communities who actually are here in need? And so there's got to be a balance to how we're doing this and talking about this, and also realism about the impact that's happening to Black people in our communities around what this immigration looks like, and not just on the color band, because we also know there's other issues there. We're not all allies. It's not all pie in the sky. Let's be honest about that. There's room to grow and build and strengthen, of course, but that's not the reality we're living in necessarily. And so, you know, I'm 100% generationally a foundational Black American woman on both sides of my family, as long as I can go through that. So I don't have any, you know, this is my home. This is where I am, you know, for hundreds of years. And so, and we're indigenous. So I just, you know, for me, I'm not confused about any of that. There's no complication on my end. I simply care about how we are affected by all these things that are happening. And so I don't want to get lost in it because I'm not an immigrant, right?
Well, let me push a little, Kenya, because I am an immigrant.
I'm not.
In the sense that my father came here. So I'm first generation, and my father is Cuban born, but he's Jamaican, right? And when I was in Jamaica some years ago, one of the first times I visited there at an international Black media conference in Kingston, I heard this guy named Professor Rex Nettlefort leading a panel describe us as New World Africans. I hadn't heard the term before, but he said, I'm an African in the New World. That's who I am. I'm an African. And so I take to that, and I describe myself as an African in the New World. Now, my family on my mother's side goes back generations and generations again, but still African.
That's our family connection. Yeah.
Still African. We're related, Jonathan. Jonathan's related to us too on my father's side, on the McFarland clan, right? Okay. So on my mother's side, we go back, but our DNA says our DNA on her side is 99% Yoruba from Nigeria, from today's present Nigeria. So I claim that because it's real, though I was born here. And so I see the connection. Yeah.
Go ahead. But, I'm sorry.
Let me finish this idea then. Yeah. So my thinking is that I note, as a journalist and activist and community here, I remember when the first of us back in the 60s, you were just a baby then.
I wasn't born.
You wasn't born, right?
Okay. I'm a 70s baby.
Me. Okay. When in the late 60s, we started hearing our people use African names and start saying Africa like it wasn't a bad word. I remember the time.
My name is Kenya.
Yeah. I remember the time when Azania Little, you know, you might know Azania. You certainly know Kinshasa and the other family members came back from Africa. And I was at my office downtown. She was writing for us as a freelancer. And the first time she came back, she said, "Hello, African." I said, "What you call me?" You know, in a fighting posture, fighting spirit. "Hello, African." I said, "What?" And she said, "Hello, African." And the more she said it, the more beautiful it sounded, the better it sounded. And I discovered something about me in language and understanding that I hadn't seen her before. So I connect with us and us globally as not a contradiction to us being here. So I honor the geography that we're in, but I also honor the connection that we are part of as well.
And I subscribe to, I don't necessarily subscribe to like African. I understand that I'm an indigenous Black woman, right? And that's my heritage right here on this land. And we can show you whatever documents you want to see, but that's who I am and who my family is, right? Generationally, I can prove that too. And so I would be remiss to not represent the foundational Black American folks on here who are saying it's not about just the diaspora. Yes, I understand, and I'm connected to BIPOC people. I care about all of that, but that does also include me, foundationally to have to be a part of this discussion to lift up the impact I'm also experiencing as we're going through this turmoil, right? You know, I'm not in agreement with the disconnection of the families and the way that all this harm is happening to our communities, the black, brown, purple, orange, all of us, right? It's just, it's not okay. Let me say that. But I don't feel like I should have to make a disclaimer of that. I am the humanitarian here.
Sure.
I think that, and that's part of the challenge, right? Black people just can't talk about what it is for us. And you know, and there is more than one type of black person here. There are some of us who don't subscribe that we came here on a boat. So I'm one of those people. And so I think that I just want to have space for us to exist in this conversation and be front and center, you know, and doesn't have to be a connection to being an immigrant. We're allies, right? We're cool. We're family. We understand that we're connected ancestral through a lot of different ways, but we can't effectively collaborate if I'm not part of the agenda front and centered in this as well, right? Because where folks are being placed at is not in Edina, right? They're actually here filling up the north side, right? They're not being placed in Maple Grove, right? They're coming here. And so if you're not talking about the impact that's happening to Black people here, right, around how this is happening, because what do we not only have ICE here, we also have the National Guard, right? That's regulating Black people, if you will, right? And so there's a lot of stuff that supremacy is doing to all of us. And ICE is for the immigration, the immigrant community. National Guard is on us, on top of all the civil rights laws and everything that, you know, has been broken down in the process, where liberals have been completely irresponsible with how they've handled our legacy. It's how they compromised it to a point where these folks feel they are justified to come in and shut everything down, because in their mind, they're shutting down the liberal agenda. But we're impacted. Our ancestors worked for these things, died for them. And these are different times to me that I would say as a 48-year-old, tomorrow I'll be 49.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. I'm sitting here like, well, we about to find out what we made of, because these are times we haven't been met with, right? Yep. At least I haven't in my lifetime. So I'm very, very, I won't say I'm nervous, but like I'm not. The only thing I know that I'm sure of in these times is that I'm going to fight.
That's right. That's right. Let me throw one more scenario out. And Jonathan, you jump in too. I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland, here with my friend Kenya McKnight Ahad, CEO of Black Women's Wealth Alliance, and Jonathan Palmer, Executive Director of the Rondo Center for Diverse Expressions. And kind of an open conversation. So if you want to join the conversation, if you're on the radio here, KFAI, jump over to YouTube and YouTube/InsideNewsMN, and you can weigh in on the conversation. I'll send you a link if you want to be on screen in the conversation with us. We'd love to have your voice and your opinion. Kenya, I remember that when I started the last comment about in the 50s and 60s, Black people started using African names, naming their children Kenya, African names, right, in the 70s, right? Before that time, we had this antipathy because our notion of Africa came from Hollywood's depiction of everything African is everything backwards, the jungle, the supremacy of the white man, Tarzan, one white boy swinging on a rope, being able to destroy 1,000 so-called natives just at will and commanding the attention and support of the natural world, the animals, obedient, subservient to this expression of white divinity, the white man. So that's the backdrop, right?
That
they created and wanted us to buy in and to genuflect to, right? Yeah. But we have not. We've resisted and we fought that and continue to fight it. The one of the elements of that is, as H.R.A.P. Brown and Stokely, you know, and that whole movement emerged, people started naming themselves differently, dressing differently, the Afro came up, et cetera. But then the next level was when immigrants came here whose names were Jamal, Abdullah, you name, you know, the Muslim name. And so when even among us, if a brother said, my name is Kamal, we'd say, what's your real name?
Yeah.
Right. What's your real name? What's your mama and daddy name you? Right. And we couldn't even accept the fact that we had the opportunity and the right to name a thing, that thing being our own selves. Right. And so here comes 40 Jamals, you know, 40 Abdis, you know, 50 Miriams, all these beautiful Muslim, Arabic, African names. And they created a certain, in my view, validation of our intuitive retention of identity that was expressed in individuals who chose to name themselves differently. What do you think?
You know, I think that the piece you're talking about, I want to throw another piece into that, which is roots.
Mm-hmm.
Roots had a strong connection into that. When you go through the whole piece with, you know, what's your name, Kunta Kinte, and he kept saying it, and they were forcing him to say Toby. You have so much of our history and so much of our culture. I'm a 70s baby, 1970 at Kenya. So much of what we grew up with, like you said, was Hollywood. It was Hollywood, it was stories, and this myth of Black inferiority that has been cast upon us. So that when we see people choosing African names, when we see Muslim brothers and sisters coming over here, that we would look down on, that we would disparage them and separate them out. And the reality is, there's room for all of us at the table to uplift indigenous Africans, to uplift immigrant Africans, to African Americans, to pull us all together. And the importance of what you see right here with the three of us, all having different experiences and different perspectives, it helps us to make sure that nobody is being left out, that as we're marching ahead, we're including everybody's agenda on the table. And the fact that we need to make sure that we are representing the aspects of our heritage and community that have been left out, that have been marginalized, that have been pushed off and cast to the side, and bring that back to the forefront and stand strong for that. Because they continually try to denigrate that and push that off as it's those people, or they're being loud, or they're being angry. We got a right to be angry. When you see what has been done to our communities, when you see what is being thrust upon our communities, and the fact that they always put the cast-offs into the Black and brown communities. They always put the rehab centers. They always put the low-income stuff. They don't come in with the resources that should be there, that we've worked to build up, that have been destroyed over time. So I think as we're looking at it, I may have strayed from your point, Al, it's very much, we've got to remember and keep our eyes on the prize. We got
to
keep
to the last minute. Yeah. Let me ask you to close us out, Kenya, because I want to leave on an upstroke here. Positive thought. What are you doing right now that people need to know about and support?
Oh, he's so funny. you know, just quickly, you know, I think that I agree. And I think I'll just 10 seconds on this. We've been reclassified so many times, right? You know, from we used to be called copper people, right? That's the copper, because we're, you know, copper colored, you know, Negro, Black, and then Jesse Jackson named us African-American. And then now we're doing this reclassification ourselves. It's called FBA. There's a whole movement of Foundation of Black Americans. Well, what does that mean? Indigenous, or, you know, descendants of enslaved Africans. And so we're figuring it out who we are. And I think that's really, I feel really good about how we're centering ourselves now. I know that it's a little bit, you know, because we're not as inclusive as we will get to, but this selfishness or self-centeredness that we're space we're in, I think is healthy, because we've always been like this. So we're kind of doing this, which is about our preservation. But I know we'll get back to a balanced place as a people, where we're just about human beings, right? About our people.
We got to close another conversation with you, Kenya, about indigenous African or Black people?
Well,
that's
tonight,
a big topic. It's big.
It is. Tonight, yeah. I am holding a women's leadership thing at the Camden Social, celebrating our two elected officials, Pearl Warren and Latricia, at the Camden Social tonight. So
awesome. Thank you so much. Go check them out. I'm Al McFarland. We'll see you next time.
You're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at KFAI.org, non-commercial, community-powered radio.